The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn Beck.
It was Tuesday night in May. Susanna Maria Feldman. She went out with her friends. They were a little bit rowdy, but generally a good group of kids. But Susanna didn't come home that night because she had been raped, strangled, and buried in the dead of night. Her body was dumped into a ditch leading to a railroad track near the refugee camp in her hometown of Wiesbaden. That's in Germany. Susanna adored her five-year-old sister, cherished her family. She was 14. They found her body 2 weeks later. By then, Ali Bashar, the 20-year-old man who had raped and strangled Susanna, fled Germany, along with his parents and five siblings, all using fake names. They went back to their home in Iraq. Ali Bashar had previously been accused of robbery, assault on a female police officer. He had also been suspected in the rape of an 11-year-old girl who lived in the same refugee station as he did. He was a refugee. Yes, did I point that out? He arrived in the country October 2015 as part of the wave of puppy-eyed refugees that flooded Europe, who many European countries so proudly gave in and gave shelter to refugees. Susanna was of Jewish German heritage. The Central Council of Jews in Germany said in a statement, "A young life has been put in a cruel way. Our deep compassion applies to the relatives and the friends. Susanna was a member of the Jewish community. At present, much of the background is still unclear. We expect the law enforcement authorities to provide rapid and comprehensive information, as well as tough consequences for the perpetrators." I tell you this story today because it's not just about Susanna. She's not alone, not by far. She is just one of a growing number of young women and young girls who are being sexually violated, abused, and in imaginable nightmares, murdered. Then they're tossed into a ditch, left in trash bins. There is no respect for life. Europe, this is what so many people were afraid of. This is what the so-called naysayers were afraid of. The governments are still not responding. The world, generally speaking, is not racist. There are racists. There are racist policies. But generally speaking, I think, at least in America, we are not racist. We are observant. Multiculturalism is the problem. If you come to our country, knowing what we offer and what we do. If you want to bring your country, your traditions, and they involve killing people, raping people, seeing others as insects, infidels, vermin, whatever it is, you're not welcome here. And it's about time our government, all around the world, starts to recognize that there is a problem. And the good people that really are refugees are going to suffer the consequences because of their inability and unwillingness to act. Because the worst part of this story is, this is just the beginning. There is an unbelievable story that just does not make any sense to me at all, other than this is what happens when a government just starts passing laws and is not using their brain at all. What is the point of prison? The point of the prison is to punish people for their crimes, but rehabilitate them so when they come out of prison, they are good citizens, right? Isn't that the point? There is a case now of Matthew Charles. It is absolutely unbelievable. In the 90s, he was nabbed for selling crack. He spent 21 years in prison. He got out of prison on parole. He has completely changed his life. His community loves him. He goes to church all the time. He's got a job. He volunteers in I think, soup kitchens. This guy is a model citizen. Well, the state decided they made a mistake because you've got to serve until 2027. It's on the books here. You got to serve it till 2027. So they took a guy who had been out on parole for how many years, Stu? Two, three? I don't even know. I think 2 years, and is a model citizen. He's going back to prison until 2027. This has got to stop. This is wrong, and there's something we can do about it. Now, he has an attorney, and Charles' attorney is on with us now, Sean Hopwood. Hello, Sean. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Glenn.
Sure. So tell me what we don't know about Matthew.
Well, I think one of the unusual things about Matthew's case is that, one, he got an extremely long sentence for a drug crime, 35 years, which in the federal system, you have to serve 85% of that. So best case scenario, he's got to do 30, 31 years. And I think what's remarkable about his case is he's done 21 years in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Not only did there's no indication he had any acts of violence or committed any other crime in prison, he didn't get a single minor disciplinary report.
And how rare is that, Matthew?
I have never seen it. And to put it in context, I don't know if your listeners know my story, but I served 11 years in federal prison myself, and I'm often held up as the model of rehabilitation. And I got two incident reports in 11 years, half of what Matthew served.
Wow.
So Matthew is quite the amazing man. And then he gets out and just makes a community and with his church in Nashville and volunteers. You know, the first 2 years out of prison after serving a long sentence is very precarious for people. They're trying to get some stability and get their life back on track. And Matthew, despite all of that, went and served at a soup kitchen every Saturday for the homeless. And what's interesting is the Department of Justice had a chance. The judge asked them, will you dismiss a charge and let this man go free rather than re-locking him up for 10 more years? And the Department of Justice said no.
Why?
Well, what they would say is they're just following the rule of law. But that doesn't make any sense because federal prosecutors decide what to charge and what not to charge every day in federal court across the country. There are many times people break federal law and prosecutors never charge it.
A lot.
Well, the U.S. Congress does not value your liberty or anyone else in this country. Because what most Americans don't know is that the Congress has found that there are 5,000 federal criminal laws, 5,000 things that are so serious that the Congress thinks that you could potentially go to jail or prison for.
So, first of all, is Matthew back in prison yet?
He is in county jail in Kentucky awaiting transfer to another prison. But we are hopeful that the president, President Trump, will grant him clemency and return him back home to the community that desperately wants him back.
I read an article about his going away party, and he was so gracious. And I mean, I wouldn't be. What was his attitude as he went on?
You know, if it was me, I would be very bitter and angry, but that's not Matthew's character. Matthew kind of left the bitter, angry guy behind in prison many, many years ago. He has been, you know, he's sad and devastated because he finally got his life back on track, only to have it all ripped away from him. But I tell you, he is also a very humble man, and he has been just overwhelmed with the number of people who, you know, his change.org petition is close to 100,000 signatures. We did a lot of interviews last week, including NBC Nightly News, and he's just been overwhelmed at the number of people from all political stripes who are supporting him and his quest for clemency.
By the way, that petition is posted at glenbeck.com if you want to go sign it. What's the goal for this, Sean?
Well, the goal is to just get enough public support that the president decides this is worth doing, and the White House is aware of Matthew's case. I have yet to run into anyone who thinks that it was a smart or wise idea to send him back to prison for 10 years. So I'm hopeful that something will happen and that the president will sign a clemency petition and Matthew can go back home to his girlfriend and his church community.
Like in a theoretical world, right, if we had an Elysium or the Matrix where we could test these things and you had criminals who had, you know, did bad things and you could somehow test the fact that maybe they could return and you could prove it, you could release people all the time. The issue is, of course, that would be incredibly risky to release them into the actual population if you weren't sure. Here's a case in which we essentially got the opportunity to test. We were able to release this guy to see if he could blend into community, to see if his life had been turned around. It's a success story. It was proven that he could. And yet, on what seems to be a ridiculous technicality, they're throwing him back into prison. I mean, it's unthinkable.
There are thousands of Matthew Charleses in federal prison that just haven't had the opportunity he has to get out. The great irony about the American criminal justice system is, one, we think that we are the land of the free, but on the other hand, America incarcerates its citizens at a greater rate than almost any other country on the planet. And two, the great irony of it is, the longer someone spends in corrections, the less likely they generally are to come out and live law-abiding, successful lives. Prison doesn't make people better.
Right, and you don't... I can't imagine going to prison for 20 years, 21 years here, and being able to even function on the outside. It was a different world that he lived in the 1990s. Completely different.
Yeah. When I was released in 2008, I had never been on the internet, never seen an iPad, an iPhone, or an iPod. One of the things I quickly realized when I went to pick up the paper and look at the classified ad section for jobs was no one advertises jobs in the classified section. And Matthew had to overcome all those hurdles too. Mm-hmm. Just the stress of so much change when you've been incarcerated that long. And yet he was able to overcome all of that and show that he's a changed person, which just, you know, in a perfect world, the Department of Justice would have recognized his rehabilitation and just cut him loose.
Sean, do you have time to stay with us for a little bit longer?
I do.
Okay. If you stay on with us, because I've got a few. This is a fascinating story and should it be more than fascinating to people. We need to take action on this. You can go to glenbeck.com and sign the petition and get the president's attention. And we've got to correct this. There's something good happening in America right now, and that is we're starting to come together on one thing, and that is prison reform. It doesn't work. Let's talk about prison reform. How do we do this, and how do we get the people out of prison that shouldn't be there anymore? Sean Hopwood, he is the attorney for Matthew Charles. He's also an associate professor of Georgetown Law. We can continue our conversation here in just a second.
Glenn Beck. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Addicted to Outrage, a new book from bestselling author Glenn Beck.
Because everybody needs to be outraged about something that is entirely meaningless. Something that really makes no difference or is none of my business whatsoever. But I need to be really outraged.
Addicted to outrage.
To stir us up and get us toward anger. And we are addicted.
Addicted to outrage. Pre-order your copy now at Amazon.com or download a preview on iTunes.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Sean Hopwood, he is the lawyer representing Matthew Charles, an incredible story. He's an associate professor of Georgetown Law. Sean, we have about 3.5 minutes. Can you tell me your story a little bit?
Yeah, so my story kind of is not too dissimilar from Matthew Charles. In 1997 and 1998, as a 21, 22-year-old, I robbed 5 banks. And was sentenced to 12 years and 3 months in federal prison, and got to prison and learned the law and had 2 briefs that I prepared for other guys and friends of mine in prison that were granted by the United States Supreme Court. And then I started winning cases in federal court all over, even though I had never been to law school and hadn't even taken freshman English and then didn't have an undergraduate degree either.
That is unbelievable.
This is just like Suits. It's my favorite show. This is exactly what happened in Suits. Oh my gosh, I can't believe that's happened.
So you get a Gates Foundation scholarship when you leave and you go to the University of Washington, and now you're a professor at George Washington Law?
I got out in 2009. I finished my bachelor's degree. I went to the University of Washington up in Seattle School of Law. My first job out of law school was clerking for Judge Janice Rogers Brown, a very conservative judge on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And then I came to Georgetown as a teaching fellow for 2 years, and I went on the market to be a law professor, and Georgetown kept me.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I have just the most amazing job where I get to help people every day.
So, Sean, the odds that if the president doesn't act, that Matthew's going to get out of prison?
Well, he'll get out, but he'll have to do 9 or 10 years. But I'm trying not to think about that, because I really think the president who, you know, I was in the White House about a month ago when the president talked about the need to reform our prisons and that it doesn't serve anyone well for people to go to prison and come out worse off.
Correct.
Rather than better.
Correct.
And he talked about the need for America to be the land of second chances and even third chances. And, you know, knowing he said that and believes that, and knowing that the White House is also working on a prison reform bill, I've been working with them for months on that, I think there's a good likelihood that the president will see the injustice for Matthew
Charles,
him lose.
That is fantastic news. We will continue to follow this case. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Tell Matthew to keep his chin up. There are people from all walks of life that are behind him. We urge you to go to glennbeck.com. It's posted right there on the front page where you can go. You'll click. It'll take you right to the petition. You can sign the petition there and help Matthew Charles. Let's right this wrong.
Seemingly, there's been
a
support.
And thanks for talking about Matthew's case, and I'm just hopeful that he's going to get to go home.
Me too.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it. God bless.
Glennbeck.com is where you can find the petition. There's really been support across the aisle. Both sides agree that this is a miscarriage of justice.
This is something we can unite on.
And I think Trump will do this eventually.
I do too.
We just need to get it in front of him.
Yes. So please, go sign the petition. It's that White House petition. You can do it now at glennbeck.com. Tell a friend.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So let me give you a fact that I want you to really remember and spread this far and wide. New figures have come out. You know, we are the worst as a nation. We're horrible at everything, right? Well, according to the Giving USA Foundation's annual report on philanthropy.
I love this story.
We have just set a record high for charitable giving in the last 12 months.
Yeah, what do we give? Like $40? Stingy bastards we have in this country.
$30.
By the way, this does not include any government giving at all.
Could I? May I?
No, I'm just trying to help. I'm a helper.
Well, you're not really helping.
I'm a helper.
You're not helping. So here's
what I do. I help.
So America gave $410 billion last year. $410 billion. It has never been that high. In fact, we eclipse the world in total dollars given from our own wallet. And the vast majority, $287 billion, was given by people and not corporations or foundations, but by average people.
Now, vast majority.
If you happen to be traveling internationally and someone says, well, you know, your country stinks on ice, you'd say, well, you know, without the ice, you stink. But that's a different story. How much money do you, France, give as a country? Because we're not just charitable in the U.S. We also provide the most foreign aid by far, and no one comes close to us. So the United States Department requested $51 billion last year to give to foreign aid. Now, Americans gave over $400 billion, but the government took money from us and gave an additional $51 billion. Just for some perspective, that's $30 billion more than Germany. That is $30 million more than the UK, $40 billion more than France, and $45 billion more than Canada. No country in the history of the world has ever been this charitable. Wow. That is truly American exceptionalism. And that comes from our Judeo-Christian upbringing. I'm going to say it.
How dare you?
I'm going to say it.
Don't.
You're a bad person.
Don't. Not only that, but the private giving, as a percentage of GDP, because everybody else will say, well, you got 300 million people. Of course, you gave more. As a percentage of GDP, we gave double the second place country.
Wow.
Doubled the second place country. And, I mean, it's triple or quadruple places like Germany and, you know, crappy France. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Is that the new name?
Yeah, it's called crappy France.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
They officially, because they thought, well, yeah, I mean, it's, why deny reality?
My country's crappy France. It works. Mm-hmm. It works. Okay, mm-hmm. That's good.
That is amazing. And that's a cultural thing, right? It's because of
our upbringing of a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One, Benjamin Franklin, what is the American religion? It's not Catholic, Protestant, or anything else. The American religion is there is a God. We should serve him. And the best way to serve him is to serve our fellow man. That's the stock of this nation. So we've always done that. Plus, we have always looked to ourselves to fix problems. We don't stand around like everybody else does. Why doesn't the country do anything about that? We do it. And the bigger our government becomes, the more socialized our government becomes, the less we will do for ourselves. That's what's happening. And the world will weep when the lights go out on America. They will weep. They will have no idea the good that we have done.
There's so many new developments as well that are really positive here in the United States. I think we're going in the right direction.
Thank you for pointing that out. Mm-hmm. Stu, because the University of California at Santa Barbara, UCSB, hosts a website that's controlled by the sociology department. It encourages parents, it encourages parents to allow their young children to participate in sexual play.
Wait, you
perfectly
mean
perfectly normal, perfectly healthy.
Hold it. You mean your college students?
No. This is they actually say that sexual play is most common between the ages of 4 and 7. And it's, quote, completely normal, generally harmless, and encourages, they're encouraging parents to allow these behaviors. So you try to be positive when you see this happen.
If your 7-year-old is playing mm-hmm. with a 4-year old? Is that, I mean, that's
perfectly normal.
What do they
generally
mean
harmless?
What do they mean generally harmless? Yeah, you know what? They don't accept that with guns, do they?
No, they do not.
Over 300 million guns. How many are used in crime? What they are generally
harmless.
Harmless.
There's a section on the website that reads, children might display affection to their friends by hugging and kissing or touching each other's genitals, which is perfectly normal. Parents should not react in a negative way because children are just exploring. So you should encourage this kind of behavior. If a child is performing these activities excessively in public, why, you might sit them down, have a talk with them about how this should be done in private.
So if it's happening like at a Taco Bell booth, you want to maybe put a stop to it.
Yes. Don't try to thwart the activity, of course, altogether. You don't want that.
Wait.
Just tell them to do it behind closed doors.
Weren't these the same people that were telling us that we had to tell our kids which parts of their body was private and which part was a no-touch?
So that nobody will touch?
No-touch zones?
Yeah. When was it when we started predicting that they would have to make this, they would have to normalize things like pedophilia? And for the last several years, we've seen this. Now, they're talking about sex among kids themselves, like a 4- and a 7-year-old inappropriately touching is perfectly normal and generally harmless. But how far away are we from telling us all that it's fine if adults engage in this activity?
You have to. If you're being consistent, you have to.
There's absolutely nothing anymore, really, that's verboten. There's nothing that you should say to your kids.
I think that word
do that.
That word makes me think of the white Germans.
Did I make you uncomfortable?
Master race. Were you uncomfortable there?
Absolutely.
That was a trigger word for me.
It was somewhat.
Although trigger word is also a trigger word because it has the word trigger in it.
Oh my gosh! Now
and that
you
makes me
have
think
made
guns.
Me uncomfortable.
I'm sorry.
I wish you wouldn't have brought up that image in my head.
I'm sorry.
Wow, you, Stu? Are you uncomfortable as well?
I'm hoping for a soundproof glass case that I can get into. I can just stay in all the time.
You know, the University of Utah has a cry closet. We should install one of those here.
I'm sorry, what?
There's a cry closet where you go and cry and get all emotional about your finals exams. They've set them up all over campus.
It has pillows. It has pillows.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, if
you a cry closet.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you're going to, and that's, by the way, we want to make sure that people understand it's okay to cry at school about a test.
Yeah.
But we just want a safe place for you to
And you might be crying because your parents told you not to touch other kids' genitals when you were a child. Right. And you're still harmed by that.
Because they may have reacted negatively.
They may have, and they shouldn't have.
They should not have to.
They have a cry closet?
Yeah, they do.
Is there any chance that anybody's ever going to grow up anymore? Is there any chance? Can you imagine a cry closet?
I know.
We used to look up, when I was a kid, we would look up to college students as like they were grown-ups. They were the cool grown-ups.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine, they're
pansies now.
Yeah, you're like, I went and somebody used some trigger language, and I had to go into the cry closet and cry all day. You'd be like,
what?
You're 8. Okay, I don't want you touching me anymore. You are weird.
Isn't it, though, because I used to have this view that, you know, we would talk about this before, like, oh, well, it's great. You know, you can have your participation trophies in your cry closets, mm-hmm. and my kids will be the ones you're serving at your job where you can't do anything because mm-hmm. you're completely unprepared for the world.
Yes. Yeah.
And I've converted this belief because I now believe that these people who are building the cry closets and crying inside the cry closets, it will become so universal that cry closets will just be the thing. That was what society will be. It's like we've talked about, like, with, you know, global warming before. You can come out and you can say, well, forget that global warming is real or not. Talk about the idea that, you know, they're encouraging you to do things that absolutely, with all certainty, even if you believe every piece of nonsense that Al Gore has ever said, will not solve the problem. You know, doing things like, well, you know, you need to unplug your appliances and when you need, you know, all these little steps mm-hmm. that will make a quote-unquote difference, when they know, you know, it's just about selling the idea, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about actually making a difference. You can't scientifically make a difference with any of those, you know, causes. So I used to think, well, eventually, like, people will realize that
this
sure we want to be clean, but, you know, this is stupid. And the reality of the situation, the reality of fossil fuels being incredibly useful to build, I don't know, a civilization on. At some point, people just get older and realize this. They're sold on it when they're dopey kids, and they eventually realize it later on in life. I no longer believe that's accurate at all. I now believe that those nonsensical ideas that are fed to teenagers just become the truth later on. Not that they're actually true, but that they're just, it's so widely believed and never challenged that they just adopt that as the entire civilization's policy.
So
we're screwed, is what I was saying.
Because I've always felt...
No pulling back from this?
No. What he's saying about how that just becomes the norm. I've always believed in self-evident truth. I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe there is...
Things aren't self-evident.
They are not self-evident to people. Mm-hmm. Your freedom is not self-evident. That is something that had to be carefully taught and studied and reasoned.
Yeah.
And then when that society had enough reason in it, it started going, wait a minute, I shouldn't have somebody else telling me what to do.
Yeah.
That's when it becomes self-evident. So it is quickly becoming self-evident that the dinosaurs that believe in cry rooms being funny or cry rooms being tragically sad because it makes you into a four-year-old that will never be prepared for life, that is going to be self-evident that we are wrong and the cry room is right.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, the first step was to kill common sense and reason, and they've successfully done that.
Are we not seeing this exact process happen with gender right now?
Yes.
Right? Like, gender, yes. Like, again, like, there was an idea. It's never been about hating someone or anything like that. It's just like, it's always been, there's been two genders, and that's the way it was.
Well, X and Y.
And there was a, right, chromosomes, right? Like, and you'd think that eventually the chromosome thing works, it plays out, and people understand that that's what it is, despite the crazy things that people would say. And what happens now is it just keeps moving down that road. And for a while, I mean, if you go back 20 years, you'll see comedians like crazy making fun of concepts like this. They would mock them, the idea that there were 100 genders.
You don't know.
Now it's only crazy conservatives who say 95 genders is not correct. And in 10
right,
years...
because I believe there are... Hear me carefully. I think there are 250 genders. I'm not part of these guys. They're haters.
And in 10 years, people will be like, do you know at one point they believe there were only 250 genders?
Yeah. It's true.
That's what happened.
It's true.
It's amazing.
Can you believe they actually believed in genders at one point?
Yeah.
Do you see the fashion show that happened in London or Paris this weekend?
I did not.
With the guys who were wearing prosthetic bellies because we live in a world now where men can have children.
Thank you. Finally.
And I mean...
I've appeared pregnant for years, and I believe in that completely.
I don't have to wear prosthetics. Yeah. I just cannot seem to give birth to this thing. So I saw a local letter to the editor. It said, something different is happening. I was recently told by a friend that our local paper is a conservative paper, and I felt once in a while the letters to the editor were written by conservative thinkers. There seems to be a change of late. I'm not sure if there's a change in the paper's role or if thinkers on the other side are stepping up to the plate, but both political parties seem so lost to their elected purpose of working for the people. They're overly focused on getting reelected and not going against their big money supporters. Last Sunday, I was watching Glenn Beck interviewed on CNN's Reliable Sources, and to my surprise, he held my attention when he spoke of Martin Luther King's call for reconciliation. He said both sides are just trying to win. We have to listen to one another. This person writes in, if we're going to continue to have a viable two-party system, we have to know what each party stands for and what they believe. And in my mind, Beck makes some very important points. I'm now reading two books about conservatives written by conservatives. To get our country back, intended by our founders, we have to step out of our comfort zone, listen, reflect, and reframe. This is fantastic. If we can have that honest discovery of each other and Ask the Ford dealer about the Ford, not the Chevy dealer. Ask the Ford dealer.
Glenn,
ask conservatives
Beth,
about conservatives,
Mercury.
Liberals about liberals.
Glenn Beck.
Everybody listen. Shh, quiet. Listen. Can you hear it? The people who are working on Italian Job 3, the writers of Mission Impossible going, you've got to be kidding me. How come we didn't think of that? That's brilliant. The perfect heist. It's theatrical. It's historical. It has crypts and old royal jewels and jet skis. This is the ultimate movie. It happened in broad daylight, 14th century cathedral on a sunny day in Sweden. Two men snuck into a cathedral. Somehow, according to the Associated Press, the two men stole a gold crown and an orb dating back to 1611. They were made for a king, King Carl the Ninth, and his funeral. Jewel encrusted crown dating back to 1625 that was used with Queen Christina's funeral. So they took the orb, the staff, and two crowns. Now, well, let me just give you the rest of the story. The items were on display at an exhibition, and people were inside when all of this was just taken. Two men smashed the security glass, protecting the artifacts. The sirens went off. They grabbed the treasure. They went outside. They hopped onto a couple of bicycles. They were weighed down by the loot packed on the back, but they were in custom made baskets for the bikes and infant carriers. Then we're not really sure what happened. Either way, they made it to a nearby dock and hopped onto some jet skis. So they made a heist of the stuff from the 14th century on jet skis. I love this story. I absolutely love this story. They haven't found them. I mean, this is really despicable and it's horrible. Or is it? Is it? Stu, I would like you to weigh in on this.
All right.
Okay. It's, you know, 1600s. You're a king.
Okay.
They make you a crown. And then they put it in a tomb with you. And then they just took it out recently to show it to everybody. It's been in a tomb for like, you know, 300-400 years.
Mm-hmm.
I say these guys aren't robbers as much as they are just the first archaeologists.
Okay.
So what's the difference between opening King Tut's tomb and taking everything that they left there that, you know, he's going to take with him? And this, you weren't using it.
Well, and they stole it from someone who they stole it from.
Huh?
They stole it from somebody who already stole it.
Right.
I mean, they're ripping off a tomb.
Right.
Right? I mean...
And they're dead. What are they going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? What, you're not going to take their shoes? I mean, if you need shoes and somebody's been buried in shoes, what? It's a waste of shoes. I need the shoes. Let me have the shoes.
Just make sure you're endorsing grave robbery.
I'm just saying... Well, after a while. I mean, not like... Shoes would probably be bad. Okay? Opening up for some shoes would be bad. Mm-hmm. And especially new.
Oh, how nice are the shoes? Some shoes can be quite expensive.
Like if they were the Pope shoes? Because those always are very fancy.
Pope shoes are fancy? I know Pope hats are fancy.
Yeah, the shoes are pretty fancy too. And the only reason why I know that is because of a drunken mess I was one Christmas Eve, at the Vatican with the Pope, and ended up with me standing on a... Pew pointing at his shoes, going, "Look at his shoes, man! His shoes are fancy."
Wait, do we have a new story alert?
Yeah, we should probably not dwell on that story.
No, anyway, I've never heard this.
I think we need to move on.
Wait, we need to move on here. Wait, is that a dream?
You know, that was a real story. It's not a proud moment of my life. No.
But we can make it into a proud moment of your life right now.
No, I don't think you can. It also involves talking nuns out of their tickets to midnight mass. I was 20. You know, I was maybe 25. And
maybe 45?
No, I was definitely in my 20s.
Okay.
And it's not one of the prouder moments of my life. And I was with a friend, and the story ends with a very
terse phone call from his very Catholic father. Who was happening to watch Midnight Mass that year from Chicago. And he called. He called his son and said, "Was that you and Glenn standing on the chair pointing at the Pope?" And all I remember was saying, "No, I don't know what he's talking about. What are you talking about?" It was
I don't want to hear anything else you're about to say.
No, we got to go on to other things, too. We just have to go on to other things.
Don't act like this is a responsible broadcaster thing to do. You just don't want to tell the story. How have I never heard this story before?
I don't know. It's not one of those that you pull out like, "Hey, I just won an award." This is not one that you pull out of the bag. So I was, you want to do this or do you want to go? I mean, we have Addicted to Outrage to play. We can only do one. What's it going
to
be?
You know, you're trying to get out of it. And
I'm
that's
just
fine.
Saying. I'm
I
just
mean, I
saying.
Guess it's your personal
no,
story.
You make the decision. I'll go either way.
I mean, I don't think there's a question here. I want to know what happened to you at the Vatican on television, apparently. Is there footage of this?
Probably at the Vatican archives. Yeah. Okay, so it's, I don't know, the mid or late 80s. Probably 1989, I think. And I had gone over to do a USO thing, you know, on an aircraft carrier. And then I decided to take a few weeks off and just, you know, just hang out in Italy and Germany and just kind of, you know, do what 20-year-olds do, I guess, you know, drink. And I stayed there. And this is really the beginning, I think, of my alcoholism, because if you travel Europe, especially Italy alone, and you discover how good red wine is, they serve it by the bottle. Mm-hmm. And so every meal is another bottle of red wine. So my friend joins me in the last week, and it's Christmas week. And and he's very Catholic. And so he says, you know, "I really want to go to Christmas Eve Mass." And I said, "Well, I think you need a ticket for that. And we don't have tickets." And he's like, "Ah, crap." So we spent, you know, all Christmas Eve, you know, just drinking. And, you know, and just kind of going around and just being, you know, Christmas jovial
right.
Americans.
Okay.
Okay. And so about 9 o'clock, we're completely hammered. And he says, you want to get in? And I'm like,
to the Mass.
Yeah, we're in St. Peter's Square. It's packed. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how are we going to get in? He's like, "I have an idea." So he leaves. About 20 minutes later, he comes back and he's like, "I got him." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" And he's, "I got 2 tickets. It's like right up front." And I said, "How did you get 2 tickets? And he said, "I talked these two nuns out of their tickets." I said, you what? He said, "No, I'm feeling bad now. I'm hammered and I'm feeling bad." I'm like, "You shouldn't have talked to the nuns out of me." He's like, "Oh, they come all the time. They see the Pope all the time. This is our one chance to see the Pope." And I'm like, "This is fantastic. Are you sure the nuns are okay?" And he's like, "Absolutely, they're okay." And I'm like, "Okay, because if they feel bad, I'll feel bad. But if they don't feel bad, I'm going to see the Pope." So we go in. And you wait and you wait and you wait and you wait and you sit and there's nothing to do. And you're like, "This is really kind of slow." And then the Pope comes in and the music starts. Everybody stands up and it's very, usually very, very restrained.
I would think it would be restrained. Yeah. Yes.
But we decided because we were about 5 or 10 people away from the aisle. And the Pope was coming, and we couldn't see past the people that were there. So we got up.
You wanted to solve a problem.
Yeah. We got up on the little folding chairs and stood on the folding chairs. And he started saying,
it's the Pope. And I'm like, I can't believe it's the Pope. Look, it's the Pope right there. And he's like, this is incredible. And I said, look at his shoes. Even his shoes are popish. Look at that.
Popish?
Well, they were. They were like, you know, I don't even know anymore, but they were fancy shoes. They were like, I don't know, red and either velvet or something, and they had Pope signs or something on them. I don't know, but they were fancy shoes, apparently, because that's all I really remember was like, look at his shoes.
Were they blurry to your eye? Was everything blurry to your eye at this point?
No, for some reason, I can see all of it. Unfortunately, not from my perspective. Somehow or another, my memory is from like a bird's eye view. It's like God gave me a little extra gift. I'm going to make sure you see this the way I saw this.
Okay, so you've now stood on a chair and pointed at the Pope's feet, and you think this is over at this point? Did they kick you out? Nothing happened?
No, not exactly. No, I mean, I don't want to, you know, let's just say this. 2 days later, on the good side, 2 days later, we were flying home. And we're walking down the streets of Rome, and you know, there's all these shops that priests shop at. You know, and they have the cassocks and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're flying coach, and my friend is a really good con man, and he said, "You want to fly first class back?" And I said, "How are we going to do that?" And he's like, "I got an idea. Come on with me."
Oh no.
And so we get to this store where it's all the, you know, stuff for, you know, bishops and stuff. And but to my credit, I said, no, this is going too far. And so we didn't do it. Although
he wanted to dress as a bishop to get moved up to first class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or just a couple of priests. And we didn't do it.
That's good. That's a good choice, Glenn. That was a good choice. And then
I wish I could tell you that the story ended with us in coach all the way back home. But it doesn't.
Oh my God.
It doesn't end in coach. And
I don't think I...
We got on the plane, and my friend had to go to the bathroom. And as, you know, just about, you know, after the plane, you know, reaches altitude, I hear an announcement that I am on my way home to get married to the love of my life, who we hadn't seen each other forever and had found each other in a very, you know, a very heartwarming way. And all the stewardesses just thought it was this the greatest story ever. So please, everybody, just give a round of applause. And I was asked to come up with my friend and have champagne in first class on the way home. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yes. It was very, that's what happens when you're one with a Pope. That's what happens.
I don't think you were one with a Pope on that
Holy.
Trip.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that.
I have to find this footage. If there's anyone at the Vatican listening, what year was this?
I think 1989.
If anyone has 1989 Christmas Eve Mass.
And you'll see us. We were there. We were there.
God, I have to find this footage now. Okay. I no longer have any other career goals.
All right. I may not have a career.
Glenn Beck. Join Glenn, Stu, Pat Gray, Doc Thompson, and Sarah Gonzalez weeknights at 5:30 Eastern on The News and Why It Matters. Tweet us your questions using the hashtag TheBlazeWhy and tune into the show to hear the answers at TheBlaze.com/TV.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Well, Stu, you just kind of blew this show all to hell.
It's the most important show we've done in years.
I got Josh holding in California. He's got some important stuff. We have really important. We have somebody to lynch as a mob today.
I was interested in that.
We have to do the lynch mob.
But I mean, I just want to make sure that we understand that somewhere out there exists video of the 1989 or 1990 Vatican Christmas Eve Mass, in which you idiotically are standing on a chair pointing at the Pope.
Not video of that. I looked up Pope shoes, by the way. Do a Google search for Pope shoes. Okay. The papal slippers are made of red velvet or silk, and they are heavily decorated in a gold braid with a gold cross in the middle. Chosen to reflect the blood of Christ's own bloody feet as he was prodded and whipped and pushed along the Via Dolorosa on his way to the crucifixion. I don't think they really reflect Christ's bloody feet. They're nice, you know. Yes, they are red. And I just remember them being very impressed. You know, I am sartorial in nature, so...
I'm not surprised. Believe me, the shocking part of the story is not the fact that you looked at the dude's shoes. Like, yeah. That seems very Glenn Beck-esque. Yeah. Yeah. The fact that you were on video, gone through this entire career in front of the media, and no one has been able to unlock video of you at the Mass pointing at his shoes and drunkenly yelling.
As I was telling you this story just a few minutes ago, it really didn't occur to me that you would be pushing for the look for that video.
It's interesting because I'm already coming up with a hashtag. Because I think this is something that America can unite on. You know, we talk about...
Suddenly have a really throbbing headache. I'm not kidding. Just suddenly, just like right now, a gigantic throbbing headache has begun.
Because there's a lot of researchers out there that let it uncover... Mm-hmm. Documents, videos, pictures.
I was making this whole thing up. It didn't.
I don't think that's true. You know what? We can figure that out, though. We don't need to take your word for it.
I tell tall tales.
See, they have photos, too. So we could probably find you in photos. As you mentioned to me earlier, that you're about, what, a third?
I don't remember. I don't recall.
On the left side, if you're looking from the back.
I do not recall. Mm-hmm.
And you said about 9 or 10 seats in, I think was the way you described it.
And I was... heavily intoxicated.
I thought you said it didn't happen. I don't.
In my imagination, I was heavily intoxicated.
I'm willing to take your hashtag ideas to get this trending. How do we find the 1989 or 19? This is a long hashtag. 1989 or 1990 Christmas Eve Mass video at the Vatican. We need something, a catchy hashtag.
Jeez, you know, it was even Pope John Paul. I am so embarrassed. It was Pope John. Yeah. Oh yeah. Paul. Mm-hmm.
I've seen pictures from the event. From the Mass, and I mean, it looks like the type of thing that you wouldn't want to stand up on a chair and drunkenly point at someone.
No, it wasn't. I remember his father being very, very clear. Please tell me that was not my son standing on a chair as the Pope came in. That's when it all kind of went, and we realized there were cameras there.
What have we done as a society in which this video... Think about, we criticize journalists all the time. How have they not uncovered this already? How has a major journalistic organization not pulled up this video throughout this entire run of you? You know, you were a syndicated
because
radio host
until
17
today,
years ago.
I apparently was very good at keeping the secret. I don't even know how it came out now. I don't know how we started down this, but everyone... You should forget this. These are things that did not happen. This is not the papal story you are looking for.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So we have a couple of things here. Stu, choose your news. You ready?
I'm ready.
Power use rises during Earth Hour for first time.
I like that one. That's pretty solid.
Mother crashes car into pole to prove God is real to children. They're both good. Choose your news.
I
Story
need
one.
To know how crashing your car into a pole proves anything about God.
Oh, you can't do the math on that?
No, I cannot.
Police say a mother intentionally crashed her SUV into a pole to prove to her two small children that God is real. The investigators...
Did the investigators investigate why that would prove that God was real? That's what I'm...
No, they just wanted to find out what the accident, what the accident was caused by. And the children told the investigator that mom did it on purpose to show them that if they believe, God would protect them.
So would protect them from the pole or protect them from surviving the crash
don't
with
you believe?
The pole?
Are you not a believer?
No, I think I am, but maybe I'm not maybe not enough, apparently.
Yeah, you...
Because I've never crashed. I've never intentionally crashed a car into a pole.
God will save you from anything.
Well, because it's weird, because it seems like God, like a big part of Christianity is what happens after you die. So I don't think he's necessarily saving you from an earthly situation every time. The point is that there's something deeper than that.
Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Are you a believer or not?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Would you bring in the flamethrower? Because God will save you from that if you believe. And if you don't believe, you didn't believe enough.
If you burn
to like, a crisp, you didn't believe enough.
So what you're saying is if I float...
You're a witch.
But if I drown, I'm not a witch.
You're not a witch.
And therefore cleared from that crime.
Correct.
That's a wonderful...
So if you believe, I can't burn you to death. Bring the flamethrower in. Sitting in the car, her children explained what happened before the crash. The officer said, "Do you think she did it on purpose?" "Yeah," said the 7-year-old. "Because she turned, her eyes were closed, and she was saying, blah, 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 I love God," said one daughter. "She didn't want us to have a car accident. She just wanted us to know that God is real." Police.
But again, why would that prove that God is real, that she crashed into a pole? Like, I can understand saying, I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to navigate this street and not run into a pole because God's going to guide me. I can understand that logic. I don't think it's a good idea.
I don't know if she had the God is my co-pilot sticker. So,
like,
I mean,
Jesus
if she
takes the wheel. Like, I could get, at least there's a sense to that, that theoretically it would make sense. Again, I would not recommend it right now. If you're in your car, don't let Jesus take the wheel. He wants you to drive your car.
I'm pretty sure that's true.
I think
But maybe it's that I'm not a big enough believer.
Boy, is she saying that God will help me navigate the streets and then she ran into a pole, therefore disproving God? Or is she saying, hey, I'm going to crash this pole?
Did they all walk away?
I don't know. You haven't included that detail.
No one was hurt in the accident.
Okay, so...
Officer said it could have been much, much worse. I'm quoting, could have been a lot worse. Could have been heavier traffic at the time. She could have hit the pole at such an angle that she did more damage to the car, but she didn't. You know why? God was her co-pilot.
Okay. So God navigated her into a lesser impact collision.
Yes.
I'm fine with that. Oh, there you go. Yeah, I'm fine with that. I mean, I protected the kids, even though the parent's a dummy.
What was the thing about, you know, don't tempt the Lord? Don't, you know, you're not supposed to...
taunt? You certainly shouldn't taunt him.
Yeah, you're not supposed to say, hey, Lord, I'll give you this, you do this. Hey, why don't I, you know what, I'm really, really hungry here out in this desert. Why don't you just turn this into a nice meal for me?
The sand.
Yeah, just so I can show you a magic trick. So I can show my friend over here, who I don't think actually is your friend or mine, but I just want to show him that you're real. So I'm going to fly off of this cliff. No, God doesn't do that, and he doesn't want you to do that. That's a bad idea.
I mean, perhaps she didn't have a deep doctrinal understanding of the scriptures. Perhaps. But the kids are going to learn a lesson about God they're never going to forget.
They won't.
They will remember
they
that
will
one.
They will remember it.
I don't know if it works out well, but they will remember
the
lesson.
Put this in your calendar. Mm-hmm. Put this in your calendar for about 10 years, because the 7-year-old will be 17. And let's see if we can find her in 10 years. Because I'd like to say, hey, that whole thing with your mom, I know we're the only ones who remember it, but
how did that work out?
We put this in the calendar.
Yeah.
How you doing now? What do you think about God?
I think pretty well is the understanding that I would have.
Story number two. Power rises in British Columbia during Earth Hour. Despite their best intentions, British Columbians increased their power use during Earth Hour for the first time in a decade. BC Hydroelectric says electricity use in the province rose 0.2% from 8:30 to 9:30 compared to the same hour the week before. Earth Hour is an annual World Wildlife Fund event that encourages people across the globe to turn off their lights for 1 hour to draw attention to climate change. That used to be global warming. Now it's just climate change. But let's remember, it used to be global warming. Why did they change it? Let me read the rest of the story. The increase in electricity is probably due to declining participation. Also, colder weather in many parts of the province. In BC Hydro report published this month, the Crown Corporation said 7 in 10 survey respondents said they did plan on participating in Earth Hour this year. But the Crown Corporation says it also marks the fifth year in a trend of declining participation in the province. So when you call people up and you survey, 7 out of 10 are like, oh my gosh, yeah, recycle? Uh-huh, uh-huh. And turn off my lights? You bet. Turn down the air conditioning? Oh my gosh, we're thinking about getting rid of our air conditioning. Soon as they hang up the phone and they stop the survey, oh man, they're making plastic in their home. They're making styrofoam and burying it out around their yard just because it'll never, you know, you gotta just bury it all around. So we don't want it all in one place. Bury it all around. And they're doing it with a window air conditioner strapped to their back so they don't get hot.
Right.
But they'll tell you they're all into it.
Everybody loves the environment until it affects their life in any way. You know, as soon as there's a moment they have to lose any of their niceties in life, they abandon it. This is one of the issues that the environmental movement is really having, in that they are trying to figure out ways to tell people, hey, you're involved, right? You're doing something. What you need to do is little steps. Little steps will help. Now, we all know little steps won't help. We've talked about this.
Well, little steps do help.
They don't help at all.
Yes, they do.
They do not help at all.
They do.
They don't.
They do.
I will tell you why they don't.
I will tell you why they do.
Sure, let me start. Number one, hey, you guys should drive less. You should buy a hybrid. You should blah, 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 blah. If you turned off every car and never let any of them run again, you would save about, this is cars and trucks, by the way, the entire transportation sector. If you turned it off tomorrow in the United States, you would save about 20% of our emissions. And you'd say, well, that's a big deal. Now, it would still have 80% of your emissions still going. However, you'd save about 20% of the emissions. The problem with that, of course, is that the United States is only about 20% of global emissions. So you'd really, turning off the number one industrialized transportation sector in the world would save you about 4 or 5% of global emissions. Global emissions grow between 2 or 3% per year. So you'd save yourself a couple years if you turned off every motorized vehicle in the United States. That is not what they're asking you to do, right? No one's saying you shouldn't drive anymore, because they know no one can do that. They're saying, well, you should get a more fuel efficient car. You should, what, you know what you need to do is you need to unplug those plugged in appliances when you're not using them. None of this does anything, which is why they constantly express these statistics in things like cars taken off the road, or certain amounts of trees. This is the equivalent of planting 4 million trees. You know why they say it, though? Because million sounds high, but it means nothing. Nothing.
Are you done?
I am done. Now, you're going to tell me why little things do make a difference.
Little steps. Little steps. I want you to hear me out.
Okay.
Okay?
You sure?
Yeah.
I owe that to Baby you after sport. You took my point very seriously.
Well, I did. Mm-hmm. I did. I listened to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It was riveting. Mm-hmm. So, you have a baby. Mm-hmm. They come out, they pee and poop all over everything.
Yes, they do tend to do that.
You take the little step of putting a diaper on that child.
Mm-hmm.
Because telling the child, hey, go to the potty, go into the bathroom and sit on the crapper over there. Baby doesn't understand it. So you first put the diaper on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start to potty train them. And after, like, I don't know, 14 years, they start to go crap where they're supposed to go crap. But those little steps helped me all the way, so I wasn't cleaning up crap. If I just wanted the big step, I'd have crap all over my house.
The diaper little is not steps. A little and step, bigger it's steps, a miracle invention.
And let me tell you something else. Big steps are even better. When they're running to the potty, big steps are better. Little steps help. Just saying. No, wait a minute. You said you would hear me out.
I did.
Now, all of those diapers are not exactly helping with the planet.
No.
But that's a completely different story. If you listen to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, it's really good. It's really good. Revisionist history, especially this last season. I think I told you to listen to one about Brian Williams.
Yeah, and usually when you suggest things, I don't listen, but that one was really a good,
thank you. Yeah,
a good suggestion. It was fascinating because it was sort of a revisiting of the Brian Williams scandal, where if you remember correctly, Brian...
He's a liar!
He's a liar, and because he said he was shot at and his helicopter was hit over Iraq, I believe in 2003-ish. And, you know, over time, he started off telling the story accurately, and it sort of meshed into this thing where he was taking credit for this heroic act. He told the story on Letterman and, in the end, lost his job and his credibility over it. And Gladwell's case, and it's backed up by a lot of science, which was pretty interesting, is that we as humans believe our memories are perfect video captures of a moment. Mm-hmm. And science and study after study after study shows this. That it's not that we actually screw these things up all the time. And the way they use these things called flashbulb moments. So like 9/11 is a flashbulb moment. We all remember where we were on 9/11. And scientists, because, you know, they're nerds and they're using us for their own purposes, every time one of these things happen, they do a study called a flashbulb moment study. And they'll go and interview all these people about what they were doing at that moment. So right after 9/11, and there's many examples of this, they go and they talk to people and they say, what were you doing at this moment? And they have them write it down in their own handwriting, their exact memories of what they were doing. And then they go back to them 5 and 10 years later and say, what were you doing on 9/11? Without showing them the piece of paper. They recount their memories and then they compare them to what they wrote down, and they're in different places. They were on the phone instead of in person.
And people are saying
all sorts of major differences.
And people will say, I don't know why I wrote that 10 years ago, because that's not true. I don't know why I would lie. And then the researcher's like, okay, so you thought you lied at that point? Yeah, I must have, because I was not there.
Yeah, and they came up with, the number was 60% of the details of the memories were misremembered in the future.
Isn't that crazy?
People actually, over time, sort of build these things, these stories in their head, and they start to believe them. It's not necessarily a lie because they are trying to better their situation. It is a mistelling of the truth because our memory screws with us over a long period of time.
It is really one of the underlying principles of my book that I think, will not be necessarily understood in a just a quick read. And that is arrogance. Arrogance leads us to believe that we are right and everything we believe is right. I believe in the same stuff I've always believed. I believe that the Bill of Rights, the Constitution in America is good. But by focusing on that, you stop listening to what other people are saying. And because they have nothing to teach you, they're just wrong. And if you start to listen to them, you can start to say, oh, wait, I see what you're saying here. Okay, you're focused on this. You're right about that. You're right. However, come with me. But because they're not listening to you, you're not listening to them, nobody says, wait. Yes, you're right about that. How many times have you done that in real life where you have to get through an argument and you're like, wait. Okay, yes, you're right about that, but that's not what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. That's not happening in our society because everyone's treating each other like an enemy. Everyone says, you're lying. Here's a case of Brian Williams, who everybody said he was lying, where science is showing, no, even your memory is 60% wrong. That's pretty remarkable. Humility is the key to what we're facing.
Glenn Beck.
All right. Today's segment of Postmodern Geometry, the hashtag MeToo dilemma. Here is the problem of the day. We have a lesbian humanities professor at an elite university who is sexually harassing a gay male student. Who is the victim? You don't need that much time, right? Of course, it's the professor. Her name is Avital Ronell. She's 66 years old, professor of German and comparative literature at New York University. She apparently is the real victim, even though she allegedly sexually harassed a former student. The New York Times wrote about the whole ordeal in an article titled "What Happens to Hashtag Me Too When a Feminist is Accused." Well, we all know the feminist is in the right. Ronell, quite publicly, has been accused of sexually harassing Nimrod Reitman, 34 years old, graduate student and currently a visiting fellow at Harvard. Now, Ronell is an academic rock star, as one colleague described him, one of the very few philosopher stars of the world. But the investigation concluded that the teacher, the professor, was the one responsible for sexual harassment, both physical and verbal, to the extent that her behavior was sufficiently pervasive to alter the terms and conditions of the student's learning environment. So she was suspended. The accusations. Reitman's claim that before the school year in 2012, Ronell invited him to stay with her parents in Paris for a few days. The day he arrived, she asked him to read poetry to her in her bedroom while she took an afternoon nap. He said, "That was a red flag. But I also thought, okay, you're here. Let's not make a scene." Then he said, "She pulled him into her bed. She put my hands onto her breast and she was pressing herself, her buttocks, onto my crotch. She was kissing me, kissing my hands, kissing my torso." That evening, a similar scene played out again, he said. From emails that he produced, "I woke up with a slight fever and a sore throat. I'll try very hard not to kiss you until the throat situation receives security clearance. This is not an easy deferral." Another email: "Time for your midday kiss. My image during meditation. We're on the sofa, your head on my lap, stroking your forehead, playing softly with your hair, soothing you. Headache gone yet?" "Yes." Startingly, is the one from 50 of her colleagues, all the educators from around the globe. Quote, "Although we have no access to the confidential dossier, we have worked many years in close proximity to the professor and have accumulated collectively years of experience to support our view of her capacity as a teacher and a scholar, but also someone who has served as a chair of both the departments of German and comparative literature at New York University. We've all seen her relationship with students, and some of us know the individual who has waged this malicious campaign against her," end quote. So the student has been expelled. The professor is fine. Now, want to take a guess where she stands on Trump? She didn't like Donald Trump. She says, "I take it as rigorously necessary that Trump's mouth hole be the flapping aperture to funnel floods of racially unleashed aggression, the toxic spill of his language, part of the recourse to crucial intersection where Twitterature meets something else." So here we have somebody who is too important to the cause, sexually assaulting someone, a young gay man, and she gets a pass because, well, she's in the right club. She's absolutely in the right club, and she's too important to lose. So we have somebody on the phone, and I haven't talked about her yet because I just want to ask her myself one last time before I introduce her. Give her the opportunity to back out
because I don't think this is going to go well for her career unless we change her name. This is how crazy things are have gotten. Can we bring her on real quick? Is she there?
Yes, I'm here.
Are you sure you want to have this conversation on the air? I know the rules of not saying where you work, but you're willing to put your name out there, which, I mean, you know, there's this private eye called Google that will find you quickly. And I don't think this is going to go well for you in the long run. I appreciate it. I want to tell your story, but are you sure?
I have been praying for a couple of days about it, and I really feel like I'm supposed to be here giving hope to other conservative professors, giving hope to conservative parents who are worried about sending their kids off to college, that I'm here to speak truth, but I also need to be respectful of the place that I work and the people I work with. And so it is a very difficult decision. So I agree. Okay. You're right. It is a risk.
I know you want to give your name, but I'm not going to give it. If you at some point want to give your name, that's fine. But I think that's just opening up a world of hurt that you don't need to go through. You are a psychology professor.
Yes.
And you have been an adjunct professor at a good college, and you're looking for full-time work, and you don't think it's going to happen because of what colleges are like right now. Do I have that
Definitely.
Right?
Yes, because there's a very clearly documented hiring bias, both an anti-conservative hiring bias and an anti-Christian hiring bias, particularly in the humanities and social sciences, which is where psychology falls.
Okay. You have been teaching over the past 8 years, and you have said that there is a shift in attitude, even by the students now. Can you tell me about that?
Definitely. When I first started teaching, it was exactly what I pictured as far as the dynamic between the professor and the students, where there was a clear distinction in roles, there was respect. And over the last, say, 3 to 4 years, I've noticed a shift where progressively students are becoming more emboldened. They see a blurring between the lines. There's less respect for me as an authority figure, and they feel like they can just challenge me. They rarely do it in class. Most of the time they do it online. So they'll send me an email or they'll post something in the end of class survey, which is supposed to be anonymous. But some of them have gone to the administration behind my back to try to, you know, complain or what have you, because they feel that I'm too strict or they want to have accommodations where accommodations aren't due. So it's become more of a place of incivility on the student's part. Luckily, I've been able to manage it pretty well, and it hasn't escalated to the point where some professors, say like the professor at Berkeley who had students disrupt the final exam to protest it, or Brett Weinstein who had his class, you know, disrupted by protesters. I haven't experienced anything like that. Most of the time, the students are good in the classroom. It's outside of the classroom, especially when they feel emboldened by being able to post online or, you know, do something anonymous.
You were teaching an undergraduate course on research methods, and you said, okay, let's look at the campus assault study, the campus climate survey that came out in 2015, and let's look at this. And what did you have the students do?
It was the point of the class and the lecture was talking about research validity, so looking at research studies and saying, is this actually valid? Does the results indicate what people are saying the results indicate? And I decided to take a risk and be bold and have them analyze the campus sexual assault study and look to see, one, does it have, like, can it be generalized? Does it have external validity? And also, does it have internal validity? Do the way that they define the terms hold up to construct validity? And it was amazing to watch the class just become shocked because they've all heard the statistics cited, but when they actually dug into the study, they started to see its limitations very quickly. And to be honest, I've never been more terrified in a class than when I was standing there and openly challenging this study and guiding my students to think critically and analyze what the study actually said.
When you say you have never been more terrified, what were you terrified of?
I was terrified that I would have a student or students in the class that would react poorly to having that cognitive dissonance, because clearly that's what they were experiencing. I was terrified that some would march out of the class and go and tell the administration. And I probably waited about a week or two thinking that the other shoe was going to drop. That somewhere, some way, I offended a student that, you know, having their worldview or having this information challenged was going to create enough dissonance that they were going to react negatively. In this instance, it didn't happen, but it's definitely a risk every time I do it. And it wasn't just that one. I also had them challenge the wage gap study. I also had them challenge the climate change study that everybody quotes the 97% agree. I took a lot of risks in order to teach my students that they need to think for themselves. They need to actually analyze these studies rather than, you know, citing the talking points that the media and others have pulled from it.
When you ask your class for counterarguments to things like microaggression, what happens?
Most of the time, they don't understand what I'm saying. They think that there's just one position out there. They've never heard that there's anything else. They've never heard an alternative position. So there was an assignment that I had to use. I didn't have a choice. I couldn't modify it. But there was a question in there about microaggressions. So I told them the way I want you to answer it is to present me both sides. I want you to make an argument that microaggressions exist and are detrimental, and then I want you to make an argument against it. And I had to provide all of the resources for them to make the counter argument, because they didn't know that a counter position existed. They had no idea how to start looking for that. It was pretty amazing to see that they weren't even aware that there's alternative positions to some of these things that have just been fed to them through their education.
So I have found, well, two things. How do we expect to have a free people and a free press if people are being churned out in colleges and universities who don't even know how to look for the other side of the story? But I have found that many times the students are hungry to see the other side. They're excited when they see, wait a minute, I haven't heard that. Even if it doesn't change their mind, they're excited about it. Is that your experience?
I would say for the most part that I've seen most students, when they get exposed to this information, when they get exposed to alternative, let's say, worldviews, something other than postmodernism, something other than critical theory, when they get exposed to alternatives, it's exciting to see, because they realize that they aren't critical theorists. They realize that they aren't postmodernists. They actually do believe in objective reality and objective truth. And there's almost a relief for a lot of them that there's something out there that more closely aligns with the way that they do think or the way that they were raised. But I always have a group in there that resists, that they are just so dead set in what they've been taught that anything that brings that cognitive dissonance, they attack. You know, one of the things I specialize in is actually teaching about marriage and relationships. And so I talk about gender differences, and I always have at least one student who yes buts me all the way through that lecture, because they want to deny the fact that there's anything either biologically based or neurologically based that distinguishes the genders and distinguishes how men and women experience life and filter information and how we communicate, which clearly there is. But I always have somebody in there that will push back. But the majority seems to really, like you said, be excited and hungry for it.
In the 1990s, I read a quote from Immanuel Kant, and he said, there are many things that I believe that I shall never say, but I shall never say the things that I do not believe. That terrified me. I couldn't even understand a world that where somebody would have to hide what they really believed. I thought, what kind of world, and how blessed are we that the world is not that way? We're that way now, aren't we?
Definitely. That's at least in the environment in which I work. But I would say also in social media, that's why I've gotten off social media, because that's a risk to my career. That's why I'm very guarded and very calculated about, you know, what I choose to say and bring up in class with my students, but also the way that I conduct myself around colleagues.
Okay.
It's absolutely true.
All right. I want to take a quick break, and then I want to come back. And I, you found, I think, an unlikely friend a strange bedfellow that gave you some advice. I want to kind of talk about that when we come back with a professor of psychology that is going to remain nameless. This should tell you where we are as a nation. This person, I think if they gave their name, they would be out by the end of the day. Just for saying what she just said to you. More in just a second.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Addicted to Outrage. A new book from best-selling author Glenn Beck.
Because everybody needs to be outraged about something that is entirely meaningless. Something that really makes no difference or is none of my business whatsoever. But I need to be really outraged.
Addicted to Outrage.
To stir us up and get us toward anger. And we are addicted.
Addicted to Outrage. Pre-order your copy now at Amazon.com or download a preview on iTunes.
We're talking to a woman who is a Christian, a conservative, and a university professor. She is an adjunct professor of psychology, and she currently is working at a more conservative or Christian college, but is looking for another placement and is a little concerned about it. I am not going to tell you her name. She is more than free to volunteer that if she wishes. But I think she's incredibly brave for coming on the program and saying what it's really like in the university system, especially if you're a teacher.
And you mentioned postmodernism earlier and how students don't react positively to it when given an alternative. And I think, isn't that, though, the reason why you're not going to be allowed to succeed as a professor? Because if there, the whole premise of postmodernism is that there can't be another option, because if there's another option, I mean, human beings are going to go towards an objective truth.
Yes, definitely. And that is something that I'm mindful of, but I feel that that's why I'm there. I feel like I'm called into this to be a light in the darkness, and I present alternatives, but I do not proselytize. I do not indoctrinate students to my way of thinking like some of my colleagues may be doing to their way of thinking. I feel that that is why I'm here. That's my motivation. So that's why I take those risks. Is if I didn't take those risks, I wouldn't be fulfilling my purpose.
I will tell you, the best professors that I've ever had, best teachers I've ever had, were ones where I didn't know their opinion. I had no idea. I would think they're arguing this so hard, this is clearly their opinion. And then they would flip. And all of a sudden they'd be arguing so hard, you're like, wait a minute, I thought you believed. No, they never said that. They're just arguing, showing you both sides and pushing you up against the wall on both sides. I think that is the way education should be.
I agree. And that's exactly how I try to approach it.
So you met with Eric Weinstein, Stein, and he was from Evergreen College. And if people don't know what he went through, he's not a guy who's actually, probably agrees with you on very much personally, but he was pushed up at Evergreen College, which is more radical than Berkeley, and went through hell. I'd like you to talk about meeting with him and what you guys talked about and how that all went, what advice he gave to you, when we come back.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
We're talking to an adjunct professor of psychology who will remain nameless, and we're not going to say where she works either, due to fear of reprisals. She'd like to have a job, but she's talking about what it's like to be a conservative and a Christian and a professor at the same time. Those things don't seem to go hand in hand anymore. And now you know why she's not going to be named here. When you started looking for another job and you realized everything is a trigger. Everything on my resume is a trigger to say no to.
You actually sought out and met Eric Weinstein. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I met Eric Weinstein. He's actually Brett Weinstein's brother. They're right. both a part of the intellectual dark web. Brett's the one that was at Evergreen, whereas Eric is a mathematician and economist, but he's also very much a part of academia.
Thank you.
And I got to briefly encounter him a couple of months ago, and I decided to ask for his advice because, yes, I am preparing to start looking for full-time employment, and my resume screams Christian. You can't hide it. And I brought that up to him. I said, I'm a conservative. I'm a Christian. I teach in psychology. I'm looking for full-time work. Do you have any advice for me? And he said, you definitely have two strikes against you. He goes, I'm not going to lie. You have two strikes against you. The only way that you're going to find full-time employment is you're going to have to find something and make it your thing. And I told him about my approach to teaching, that I try to be balanced. I try to present both sides. I focus on critical thinking and analysis. And he goes, then that's it. Make that your thing. You're going to basically have to market yourself as, you know, this particular approach in order to stand out. But he very much confirmed my fears that those are two strikes against me, and that I have an uphill climb in order to find full-time employment.
What did you think when you saw what his brother went through at Evergreen?
It was scary because, if you recall, that was the same time period that Milo Yiannopoulos experienced the protesters at Berkeley. So it was almost like this weird moment in history where the shift was very obvious and very clear, and it was happening at two different universities where these students felt so emboldened that they could behave this way. And then
they held him against his will in the library for several hours for a mock trial, and several of the professors that were there were almost testifying against him in this kangaroo court. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yes, and those same students held I think it was either the dean or the president of the university held him hostage, wouldn't even let him go to the restroom by himself.
Correct.
And then the security on campus told Brett Weinstein, don't come to campus because they're going car by car looking for you. It was insane. And this is not a big university. That's actually a pretty small college in Washington. And the idea that students were getting away with this behavior, it definitely is scary to think about what might happen, because he's actually a liberal. He still says he's a liberal.
He's an evolutionary scientist.
Yes,
there's like
is.
Very little common ground here with most conservatives. He is he's a diehard liberal, but he's a classical liberal that says, I want stats. I want proof. Let's use the age of enlightenment. But that is what postmodernism and I think universities are trying to crush right now, is the modern world, the world that was created through the Enlightenment.
Definitely. And that's something that I've heard both Brett and Eric Weinstein talk about, is that they are against postmodern thinking as well. And that's where we find alignment, is even though politically we may diverge, they're both atheists, I'm a Christian, but yet we've aligned on this common cause of saying, hold on a second, you don't get to just redefine reality. You don't get to just redefine language. You don't get to personally choose what is truth and what is not.
He was one of the most popular professors at Evergreen. Everybody loved him. Highest marks from students. But because he said, wait a minute, I'm a scientist. And X and Y mean something. There's an X chromosome and Y chromosome. It doesn't mean that you deny that. It doesn't mean that I now have to go in with your delusion. There's an X and Y. Let's talk science. That made him have to have police protection and actually start to teach his class out in the public square, because they said, we're not going to be able to protect you in the university. It's crazy.
It is, and it's absolutely terrifying, and that's why at the university I'm at right now, it seems like the students are pretty evenly divided, so it doesn't seem like I'd be overwhelmed like I would at a more liberal college like that, but when I'm going to apply at other universities, I don't know what kind of climate is there. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is, it's not just a question of, will they even call me for an interview? Like, will I even get hired? But if they do I even want to work there? Because, you know, less than 8% of psychology professors identify as conservative. And many universities don't have a single conservative on staff, period. So that's another thing I have to think about. It's not just, will they hire me, but is that an environment that I'm going to even be able to be successful? Am I going to be able to even teach?
Do you know who David Glertner is?
No, I've not heard that name.
David Glertner was actually the first guy the Unabomber tried to kill. He lives in an awful lot of pain now. He survived. He is a futurist, but he is also the son of a rabbi, deeply religious. He is a math professor. He won, I don't remember what he invented, but he invented, you know, I don't know, the cursor or something for Apple. They took that technology and made it theirs. He sued them. I think he won like $500 million in a lawsuit. The guy's an absolute genius, but is very concerned about the universities. He's at Yale now, not real popular on campus. I think he is with the students because he's so smart. But we have talked before about the university system is coming apart. It's just not going to be there, you know, 10 years of the way it is now. It won't work. And being able to do things online. Have you thought about doing a class online?
I have been asked to do classes online, and I've tried it. The problem with being a professor online, at least with the way that it's been given to me by this university, I don't know how other universities do it, is I basically just grade. There's no lecture. There's no lesson. They're given a textbook to read. They're given assignments to do. And then I just show up and grade. Hmm. And that's frustrating because then there's no teaching.
Yeah, no, that's not the
TA.
May I put you in touch with David Glertner? Because
yes.
You should talk to him. He might be able to advise you. Or maybe if I'll ask him and see if he'll come on and the two of you can have a conversation, because I think it would be helpful for a lot of people who are in your situation, whether they're at a university level or not, just trying to find their way through this madness of this world and how to navigate it.
Definitely.
Great.
That sounds great.
Going to give you another chance. I suggest you don't take it, but if you wanted to introduce yourself, you may.
To be honest, it's a really big risk to do that. And like you said, that Google machine is pretty powerful.
Yep, that's fine. I just wanted to give you the opportunity. I applaud you for not taking it. Thank you so much. And we'll be in touch. God bless.
Thank you.
You bet. Really, I cannot believe the world we live in now.
It's the Immanuel Kant thing you were talking about earlier. You know, I mean, we're really in a time where you can't stand up as a person and say the things you believe.
And how many of us are really saying the things that we believe? I mean, that's my problem with today's society is, have you really thought all this stuff through? Are you really that sure? Are the things that you're saying, let me say it this way. I remember when I had to go on tour for the Christmas sweater. And that was the hardest thing I've ever done because it was a personal story.
I remember that. Yeah.
Of my mother's death. And
you were a wreck.
I was a wreck.
Period, yes.
It was horrible. What you didn't know at the same time that was happening, I was under the first real active death threats that I had. I was still working at CNN and I had these 9/11 truthers. Thank you, Alex Jones. Coming after me and saying that I was the cover-up guy. I was the CIA operative and the cover-up guy for 9/11. And they were threatening us. We actually had one of our tour buses run off the road. We had to switch tour buses all the time, so nobody knew which one I was in. And luckily, the one that I wasn't in was run off the road. I had a guy come up into me online. The key words were all traitors. What was it? All traitors will be eliminated, I think. I had to go into crowds every single day. And knowing that there was somebody in there that probably wanted to kill me. And a guy came up and every spider sense in me just went off. And it was like, this guy, this guy, this guy. My security felt it too. They came right to my side and I'm like, I'm not going to be afraid. I am going to shake his hand and wish him Merry Christmas. And I stuck my hand out and I said, Merry Christmas. And he had his hands in his pockets and he said, all traitors must be. And he started to take his hand out of his pocket and he was on the ground before he knew it.
And I remember sitting in the back of the tour bus and saying, I will not die for the things that I do not believe. I will not die for stupid stuff. Because I said something and I was, you know, just going off half cocked or it was funny. I am not going to die for that. What is it that you're worth? It's worth dying for. And I got through that time by imagining the worst thing that could happen. And to me, the worst thing that could happen, I envisioned myself on the sidewalk, knowing that that was the last few moments I had, and I was nowhere near my family, and I would never be able to say goodbye to them. And I imagined the worst thing, so then I wasn't afraid of it anymore. Strangely for me, I don't know if that's the healthy thing to do or not, but strangely for me, it worked. That and a pact with myself, don't say anything that you don't believe. How many of us have done that? How many of us have had to? Our last guest probably has. Not die, but not be able to work again. We're entering the time that I have warned about for so long. And I've told you, you're going to be mad. You're going to be angry. There are going to be people that want to take you to that anger and have you express that anger, and it will be the wrong direction. We are encouraged now to embrace our outrage. We are encouraged to just ratchet it up. Say it back. I'm tired of people saying and just taking the punch. I'm telling you, that is the wrong direction. The right direction is to take a moment before you go online. And I don't know if you can do this without the real threat. But that threat will come to you. And before you go online, before you start to have a conversation, ask yourself, am I willing to literally fight over this? Am I willing to literally be beaten in the streets for this? Am I willing to never be able to work again for this? Am I willing to die for what I'm about to say? If you take that attitude and you couple it with courage that you will say the things that you believe, we'll be able to back away from the edge and the precipice, and we'll be able to save the rights of all mankind, even those we vehemently disagree with. So yesterday I got on my wife's, what is it, a Peloton bike?
Oh, no. Oh, good God.
Good God. First of all,
oh no!
Stop with the clips on the shoes and everything else. What a scam this whole thing is.
That's just to make you buy the shoes.
Just make you buy the shoes. That's it. Yeah, well, I'm afraid my feet are going to fly off. No, my feet have never flown off any bike in my life.
Possibly you're not using it at the highest level. I'm gonna throw that out there that maybe.
Well, here's an idea. Mm-hmm. Then make it so I could use it at the lowest level and the highest level. So you don't have to have the stupid clips. What a ridiculous, it's a scam.
The thing I love about that bike, because we have one as well, is it's like $2,000 for this bike that you buy. And, you know, my wife had to have it. And yeah, then what they do, too. The reason why it's a, whatever it is, $2,000 bike is because it's got this giant screen on it.
And you can't watch TV on
you
it.
You can't watch TV. You got to watch their classes.
I don't want to watch their classes.
By the way, they charge you $34.95 a month to access. It's incredible.
Wait, I'm paying...
You're paying monthly for that thing, too, after you pay the thousands of dollars. It is a fantastic
scam.
Business.
It's a scam.
I was riding
that bike. I was just getting more and more pissed off at it.
I'm in capitalistic awe of that company.
And by the way, can I just ask a question? I know this dates me. Mm-hmm. But when did riding a bike become spinning?
as of... 4 minutes ago, I had no idea.
That's people would say I'm going to a spinning class. I don't know. You plates on a stick or something. I don't know what the hell you're doing. I don't care. I'm never going to go.
What a stunner you brought it to things in the kitchen.
Right.
No, you're legitimately that far away from gym culture.
I am that far away.
This is not a new development.
No, I know it's not a new development, but it's a stupid development.
Glenn Beck, Mercury.